A brand new week with a brand new show on Monday, March 14th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. Up front, I wondered why we keep wasting time trying to outlaw flavored vaping cartridges. Melvette Hill from the Connecticut Parent Teacher Leadership Institute talked about a push to get more people of color to run for statewide political office. Dr. Richard Cravats, author of the new e-book, Jew Hatred Rising, The Perversities of the Campus War Against Israel and the Jews, talked to us about the rise of college campus anti-Semitism. We start today with this. We've got just boatloads of solvable problems here in the state. Some things are tougher than others. I get that. I understand that. Some things take more time than others, and sometimes change is difficult and tough. I get that. I understand that. But again today, we get tied up in knots. In Hartford, the Public Health Committee, the General Assembly, hearing more testimony today about a story and an idea that just won't go away. The proposal here to ban flavored vape juice in Connecticut. I mean, this one has gone over and over and over again. And you wonder why we can't get anything done. Now, as a guy who's a free market guy and doesn't think adults should be penalized because kids are breaking the law, or their friends or parents are breaking the law, or some retailers are breaking the law, I happen to think this is just me. You could think I'm crazy. You can get all mad and ticked off at me. I think this is a huge waste of time, honestly. I honestly think this is, when you come right down to it, I think this is a huge waste of time. Now, you remember this started a couple of years ago with the thinking and the reasoning that these flavored vape products and cherry and gummy this and bubblegum that and watermelon and lemon, you know, are the pure belief is these vape pods that you put in a vape pen and you're not actually smoking a cigarette, you are vaping, you are sucking in, you know, vapor, heated vapor that contains pure nicotine. You know, the argument here is that these are purposely targeting young users. Well, all right, maybe they are. Maybe they are, but this continued push here at the Capitol is, I think, pitting two trains of thought here. And it's very illustrative of the arguments that we have sometimes in society that are really weird. What are you talking about, Paul? Well, I'll tell you. On the surface, you may think this is pretty simple. Well, you know, these flavored vape pods that come in all these, you know, yummy flavors are obviously targeted, if not at minors, then, you know, young folks who barely turn 21, and that's not right. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it isn't right. I don't know. But again, the thing you have to understand here is when you ban stuff, and that's why I'm very careful to engage in all-out bans, even though experts say, one expert quoted here, restriction of flavored vapes will lower youth vaping rates and lower youth tobacco use. Well, maybe, but, you know, the bottom line here is when you think you're doing good, sometimes, when you think you're doing good because laws are being broken, then maybe your thinking needs to be changed. You know, it needs to be altered a little bit. And what I mean is, kids, those that are minors, shouldn't be using flavored vapes or any other sort of vape cartridges or any other sort of smoking tobacco or chewing tobacco or dipping tobacco. So I get that. I understand that. But why would you want to ban something that maybe an adult likes, or somebody who is of legal age 21 and over, sound mind and body and all that. And maybe, and this is something a lot of people don't think about, but I know this personally from people that I know who have used these flavored vapes to help them, you know, to help them quit smoking. Why don't you just leave them where they be and enforce the laws better? Right? I mean, in enforce the laws better. Maybe we should ask ourselves, why are these kids, able to get these flavored vape cartridges? Maybe we should ask that. And again, because kids may be breaking the law, because parents, guardians, retailers may be breaking the law, why do we rush to ban something because people aren't using it properly? You see what I'm saying here? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And in this push to ostensibly be, I don't know, to ostensibly be, you know, responsible, health conscious and all that, it's going to hurt legal retailers who in many areas make money off this vape, off these flavored vape cartridges or capsules, and they pay taxes on it. So again, here we go round and round and round on something which I think if we just enforced the law as far as retailing in this state on this stuff, I don't know what the mail order complexities are, if there are any. But before we scramble to ban something that may not favor it from a financial point of view to adults and businesses, why don't we take a look at how these kids are getting these vape cartridges? Because it's got to be from either their parents or their guardians or their friends or their local bodegas or their retailers or their gasoline convenience stations, convenience stores at gas stations. So again, I'm sorry, but I think this twisting ourselves in knots here on the legislative level about banning these things, I'm sorry, but to my, you may not like this, but to me, it's a waste of time. It's an utter waste of time. You create a black market for these things. And I'm sorry, I just think we have far more pressing issues than to, as far as I'm concerned, waste legislative time on this. What do you think? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Or am I wrong on this? Am I being short-sighted? Do we have to ban these flavored vapes because they are targeting minors and kids? Well, if they're targeting minors and kids, how are the minors or the kids getting their hands on this stuff? Think about that. Can we think about it from that angle, please? Well, how to get more people of color, to run for office, for statewide office here in the state. You know, you have a lot of folks of color who are doing reasonably well in some areas of Connecticut on a local level, but what about running for governor, for lieutenant governor, for the constitutional offices, for the state house, for the state senate? It's often not easy. And there is a 2-weekend symposium going on to see what we can do to better that. Now, this started with day number one last weekend on Saturday the 12th, and this coming Saturday the 19th is day two of that symposium, those 2 weekends put together through the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, CCM. If you want to check them out, ccm.ct.org. And joining us right now is one of the folks who's taking part in this, and she'll have a big part in the next weekend's training, and that is Melvette Hill, who joins us now. Melvette has been extremely active in state politics. You may recognize her name. She's currently from the Connecticut Parent Teacher Leadership Institute, and we welcome Melvett Hill to WICC. Hey, Melvett, it's Paul at WICC. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
Hi, Paul. I'm doing great. I just want to do a little correction. So I'm from Connecticut's Parent Leadership Training Institute, which is a family initiative of the Commission on Women, Children, Seniors, Equity, and Opportunity. We've been around for about 30 years in Connecticut, so glad to be here with you today.
Yeah, I left a word out there, too. Thanks, Melvett. So this has always been, I know, Melvett, an area that a lot of people think is outside their reach, outside their realm of responsibility. And I know there's been these candidate workshops over the years, and, you know, several folks have gone after that. So we have this two-weekend symposium, these two-weekend workshops. One was started this past Saturday by CCM, and another one is coming up this coming Saturday, I believe, the 19th. What is your role in all this? Talk about the issue that we face here.
Well, so my role is I'm moderating a panel this Saturday with some of our elected leaders who are state leaders. And, you know, this is my second time doing it. It's really an honor to be able to kind of be in that space and hear from leaders. Last year we did city officials. This year it's going to be state leaders. Hear about their journey and why they decided to run. And in many cases, right, when we look at people of color, it's because, number one, they want to make change happen, but also there needs to be representation. People need to feel that they're being represented, like, you know, by people like them, right? People who look like them, who have the values that they have. And many people of color won't run because they don't really feel that they'll win because they're people of color. And also they haven't seen that many people of color in front of them leading, right, and in these elected offices. So that's my role. I'm so glad to be partnering with CCM on this, as well as the Yale Campaign School. It's really good work.
But that must be troubling to you when you see that people, Melvett, don't think they can run. Because if, for example, you look at the leadership role right now in the General Assembly, all the way from the top on down, you know, you do have some very prominent people of color there who have been in leadership and have been there for some years in some spots.
Yes, we do. I mean, but when you look at how many people we have, how many offices statewide, how many representatives and how many state senators and all the other positions that exist at the state level, there aren't that many people. It's a very small percentage. Now, we do have people who have been around, like, you know, one of my favorites, State Senator Marilyn Moore out of Bridgeport, you know, Doug McCrory, lots of other leaders, right? Also Brandon McGee, who now is, you know, kind of moved on to other things. But there's not that many, right? There's a very small percentage. And some of them have been in their roles for many years, some not so long. But we need more. Our state, the diversity of our state is changing. We also have, like, Hilda Santiago, right, who's been in the game for a while as well. But the demographics in our state, they're changing, right? And people need to be represented by people like them.
Melvett Hill is the guest. Melvett, hang on. We'll be right back with you. We'll learn more about your efforts to get more candidates of color involved in state politics. Traffic and weather together right here on a Monday on WICC. And we continue straight ahead with another check of traffic and weather together. News at the top of the hour. A few more minutes there. We're glad to have Melvett Hill with us. She's from the Connecticut Parent Teacher Leadership Institute. She'll be part of a panel coming up on day two, Saturday number two, coming up this weekend, of a two-day symposium, a gathering of some great minds, sponsored by the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities. Representation matters. Are you ready to run for state office? Trying to get more candidates of color into the mixer. Melvett, is one of the problems maybe that people think they look at the immediate thing and say, how do I get the money? It takes money to do this. And are they not familiar maybe with the state public financing of campaign rules and opportunities there? Is money ever a question here, do you think?
Yeah, you know, certainly money is a question. It, you know, people always hear candidates talk about fundraising and having to reach certain goals. And if they don't know the inner workings of, you know, how to run a campaign and campaign finance and all the rules, then certainly they're going to be discouraged, you know, in addition to the other things, right? So there was an article in Psychology Today, I think it was back in December, and it talked about, you know, people of color struggling with their racial and ethnic identity development, right? Citing that because there's a lack of representation of seeing themselves, even in the media, right? That how that negatively impacts your self-esteem and their overall views of their racial and cultural groups. And then, so then what happens, right? You know, there people have these mottos that say like, oh, it's hard to be what you can't see, right? If I can't see doing it, it's hard for me to believe that I can do it, right? And so, you know, when women, and especially women of color, don't see themselves represented in different fields, especially in politics, they may internalize that those careers, those jobs, those opportunities are not made for them, right? And so when people of color don't see themselves in the arts, in government positions, they're likely to have those same messages, feel that same way.
It's almost, I get, it sounds to me, Melvette, almost like a chicken or the egg thing. It's like, what do I, like, do more people of color have to get there first to inspire people to run, or do they have to be inspired to run first before the successes are shown? So I can see how it's difficult to get that across to people, looking at it from afar.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. You know, which one comes first? But I think the more people see people of color in these positions, the more they're inspired to try, right, and to learn more, right, and connect with them, right? And I would say that even the leaders in our state who, you know, who are from, you know, various backgrounds, they're kind, right? They're willing to talk and encourage others to come along, right, and to step up to where they are as well. I think that they are encouraging, and also, you know, there's room for everyone, right? There's not like that there's not room. There are plenty of positions, plenty of opportunities. And so I think they're welcoming and even looking to probably mentor people.
And the moderate, you're going to moderate this panel of seasoned experts, I see, Melvette, coming up this coming Saturday, the 19th. And it certainly looks like it should be a fascinating discussion with, you know, some of the people you have on that panel.
Yes, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. So we have a State Representative Allie Brennan, State Representative Joe Dela Cruz, and State Senator Tony Wang, and also State Senator Marilyn Moore. And then there's someone from the Senate Republicans Office of Community Development and Public Affairs of Avery Gaddis. So that's the panel I'm doing. And then, of course, the House Majority Leader, Jason Rojas, is doing a workshop on state government and finance 101. It's really going to be a great day on Saturday.
And Melvette Hill, we thank you for the time. Good luck. And hopefully we can chat down the road. Keep the number on hand. And whenever you want to get something to us, we'll be happy to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Have
Thanks.
A great day.
Thanks. Melvette Hill, who's going to moderate a panel coming up this coming Saturday. She is from the Connecticut Parent Teacher Leadership Institute, and this is a multi-day, two-weekend event to get more candidates of color to run for state office. We turn to the problem of anti-Semitism on many schools and college campuses around the U.S. Our next guest has published over 350 articles, op-ed pieces, columns, and chapters in books on campus anti-Semitism, campus free speech, terrorism, constitutional law, Middle East politics, and more. His previous books have included Genocidal Liberalism, The University's War Against Israel and the Jews. He has a new e-book out, Jew Hatred Rising, The Perversities of the Campus War Against Israel and the Jews. We welcome Dr. Richard Cravats to us right here at Connecticut Today. Dr. Cravats, it's Paul Pacelli here. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. You know, I've read so much about this, Dr. Cravats, as part of my prep for the show here on a daily basis. When do you think, Dr. Cravats, when was the real birth of this modern movement that I see and discuss me on many college campuses aimed at and fueled by anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish state thought and the vitriol that many Jewish students? Is there a point that we can point to when this started to get really bad or not?
There isn't a particular point. In 1967, when the Israeli troops were victorious in the Six-Day War, that transformed the image of Israel from a victim into a oppressor and a bully. So worldwide sentiment about Israel for many people was transformed at that turning point. And that was the beginning of a worldwide campaign that looked at Israel as being a colonial usurper of indigenous Palestinian land, and the creation of a false narrative about Israel. On college campuses, I've been writing about this topic for at least a decade. So part of it has to do with the inclination of many young students and leftist professors on campuses to see Israel as a last vestige of militaristic colonialism, in the same way that people don't like American imperialism, for example. And they have started to look at the Palestinians in the way that many in the West looked at the beleaguered South African blacks who were under an apartheid regime. So now that apartheid has been destroyed in South Africa, the Palestinian cause is the new favorite third world victim group that's paid attention to on campuses.
Dr. Richard Cravats is the guest. More with Dr. Cravats. Dr. Hang On, we'll be right back with you. His new e-book is out there, and it is called Jew Hatred Rising, The Perversities of the Campus War Against Israel and the Jews. More on this fascinating topic straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. As we continue here with our guest, talking about the unfortunate continuing rise in anti-Semitism on many college campuses and institutes of higher learning around the country, Dr. Richard Cravats, his ebook available now, Jew Hatred Rising, The Perversities of the Campus War Against Israel and the Jews. You know, Dr. Cravats, I think we can all agree that no matter which nation we're talking about, Israel, any other nation, not everything every nation does is correct and can be debated. I think we can agree on that. The disturbing trend I've always seen here, Dr. Cravats, is now this growth of silencing people. And when I was in college way back in the late 70s and early 80s, and I was at BU, one week we'd have somebody from the American Communist Party. The next week we'd have somebody from the John Birch Society. The next week we would have somebody representing Israel. The next week we would have somebody representing the Palestinians. But you know, Dr. Cravats, I never remember them being shouted down or stopped from speaking. I never remember any mob descending in our student union and saying this person should not be allowed to speak. This is what troubles me today. What are your thoughts on that?
This has become an enormous problem for people on campus who are supporters of Israel, because university campuses now are obsessed with race. And the discussion about Israel and the Palestinians, unfortunately and falsely, has started to concentrate on the idea that Israel is, like South Africa, a racist apartheid regime. So in this way of looking at that situation, Jews are considered to be white, and the Palestinians are considered to be brown or people of color, so that Jews on campuses are not perceived to be in a minority group, even though by their numbers, for example, they certainly are a minority in the American population, but they are said to enjoy white privilege. And on university campuses, there are 200 chapters, for example, of a toxic radical student group called Students for Justice in Palestine, who are the modern equivalent of the brown shirts from 1939, who make it their business to shout down, disrupt, and try to silence any pro-Israel speaker who comes on campus, any pro-Israel students or organizations. And that ranges from banishing kosher foods and hummus from the University of Toronto, for example, to shouting down Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador, as he was at University of California at Irvine, where 19 radicals stood up and wouldn't let the ambassador speak in defense of Israel. But at the same time that they're perfectly willing to subjugate all speech and thought from any Israeli supporters, they're very insistent on protecting their free speech so that they're able to promulgate all of the lies and misperceptions and distortions about the Israeli-Palestinian history and the current situation on the ground.
And Dr. Kravatz, the disheartening thing that I see on what you just said, and I'm sure you feel this way too, are the gutless, spineless university presidents and provosts and leaders who allow this to happen only to keep the calm, quote unquote. Very few of these folks, and there are some here and there, and it's refreshing, but very few of these folks, Dr. Kravatz, have the guts to essentially say in so many words, sit down, shut up, and if you disagree with something, you don't scream at them or prevent other people from listening. You respectfully ask questions and engage in a dialogue. But that doesn't happen a lot, does it?
No. And part of the problem, as you said, is that many college administrators lack the bravery to call something wrong when it is wrong and call something right when it is right. And they try to be diplomatic about it. The other thing that they are faced with as administrators is that they are terrified of being called a racist or that they are overlooking the perceived rights of minority groups, which, as I mentioned before, don't now include Jewish students. So administrators don't look at Jewish students as either deserving or needing protection from an administration. Whereas if a student is gay or Hispanic or Muslim or Black, everybody walks on eggshells and makes sure that they are not harassed or spoken poorly about, so that Middle Eastern students and the enemies of Israel on campus have been very adroit and successful in making themselves be perceived by administrators as victims of Zionist forces or the Jewish lobby or these large unseen forces of evil that supposedly are trying to suppress what they say is just criticism of Israel, but is actually the new form of anti-Semitism, which is an unbridled, unrelenting, vicious attack on the only Jewish country in the world, disguised as mere criticism of Israel. But what we know in most instances is a way of furtively hating Jews by hating the Jewish state.
And Dr. Kravatz, it's mind-boggling to me, as you say, that there's so many groups on these campuses, pro-immigrant, pro-woman, pro-LGBT, pro-this, pro-that. And I wonder if when they're screaming and yelling their heads off about Israel, do they not realize that Israel is pretty much the only country in the Middle East that lives in the present time when it comes to gay rights and women's rights and multinational people working in their country. The other nations in the Middle East aren't exactly, some of them are trying, but aren't exactly up to full speed the way Israel is for recognizing what a functioning modern society should be like.
You're absolutely right. And this is what the great British writer Melanie Phillips called the world turned upside down. There's an interesting poster that has gone around in the past, and it's of a demonstrator holding a sign that says Queers for Palestine. Now, as you know, in Iran, gay people are hung from cranes and killed for being gay. And if a queer person, like the person holding that sign, was in Gaza, for example, they would end up being dragged through the streets on a noose tied to a motorcycle. So the idea that progressives and liberals and leftists on American campuses have positioned Israel as some kind of a tyrannical, anti-human rights state where minorities are oppressed is simply an inversion of the truth. Because as you said, Israel is living in a sea of totalitarian regimes that surround it. And the non-Jewish citizens of Israel, the 20% of Israel's population that are not Jewish, enjoy more civil and human rights than they would in any country surrounding Israel. And yet Israel is perceived to be, as I said, a colonial apartheid regime built on stolen land that was taken from an indigenous people. All of what I just said, of course, is factually and historically not true, but it has been presented and accepted as a narrative that has been very artfully and successfully created by the anti-Israel forces throughout the world. And the people on campuses who push boycott, divestment, and sanction resolutions through student governments targeted at ending relationships with Israel and barring Israeli scholars from doing cooperative research, for example, is part of a worldwide campaign that goes through the diplomatic halls in Washington, D.C., and through the UN, and through many countries, through the EU, and many countries obviously in the Middle East, who have a profound and unrelenting loathing for the Jewish state. And so what's going on university campuses is a microcosm of it, but it's representative of the same sentiment.
His previous works include Genocidal Liberalism, the University's War Against Israel and Jews, his current ebook, Jew Hatred Rising, The Perversities of the Campus War Against Israel and the Jews. Dr. Richard Cravats, Doctor, thank you. What can people, where can they go to get more information on your writings?
Well, the ebook that you just mentioned can be downloaded at no cost, and I'll give you the web address if any of your listeners are interested in taking a look.
Mm-hmm.
It's stopcampusjewhatred.org. Stopcampusjewhatred, all one word, .org. And there they can download the book. I'm the only Richard Cravats in America, so if someone Googles my name, there are many articles about this topic that we've discussed today that they can take a look at. The book itself is a compilation of a group of articles on this topic, but there are many others.
Great. Dr. Cravats, we thank you. Good luck, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir. Be good.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Dr. Richard Cravats.